Welcome to the Sagebrush Trail. Stories of the West, from the frontier to the Yukon. I'm Mardell, reading Delilah of the Snows by Harold Benlon. Chapter 25, Tomlinson Gets Away. The early Canadian supper had been cleared away, and Sewell was sitting with Grace Colthurst opposite him by the little stove in the inner room of the Gold Commissioner's dwelling, as he had done somewhat frequently of late. The Major was apparently occupied with his business in the adjoining room, for they could hear a rustle of papers, and now and then the shutting of a book through the door, which stood partly open. He closed one a trifle noisily, and the next moment his voice reached them. "This thing has kept me longer than I expected, but I must get it finished before I stop. Esmond's sending a trooper off first thing tomorrow," he said. "Still, I shall not be much longer, and then we'll get out the chess." Colthurst had spoken loudly, and as Sewell and Grace did not raise their voices, it appeared probable that he could not hear what they were saying. Sewell smiled as he glanced at the girl. "I'm not particularly impatient or sorry for Major Colthurst, though one could fancy that his dislike of official correspondence is quite as strong as his fondness for chess. He knows exactly what he has to do and does it without having to trouble about the results, which in his case concern the crown. That naturally simplifies one's outlook." "The Major," said Grace reflectively, "has arrived at an age when one does not expect too much and is content with the obvious, which is certainly an advantage. And we, being younger, are different in that respect." Grace was a trifle disconcerted, which occasionally happened when Sewell talked to her. Though she looked at him with a little smile in her eyes, it was, at least, not very clear to her why she found it pleasant to discuss such questions with him in a confidential voice, when she had, to all intents and purposes, plighted herself to Ingleby. Sewell was always deferential, but there was something in his attitude which suggested personal admiration for her, though she was not quite sure that the vague word liking was not a little nearer the mark. How far that liking went, she did not know, but while she had no intention of allowing it in any way to prejudice her regard for Ingleby, Sewell was, she knew, of subtler and more complex nature, and the craving for influence was strong in her. She knew what, under any given circumstances, Ingleby would probably do, and though this was satisfactory in one respect, it had its disadvantages. She had long been troubled with a fondness for probing into masculine thoughts and emotions, and it pleased her to find an opportunity for directing them, which was not often afforded her in Ingleby's case. His program was usually cut and dried, and it was, as a rule, an almost exasperatingly simple one. "I suppose we are," she said. "When I know what is expected of me, I usually want to do something else." Now, Sewell was not aware how matters stood between her and his comrade. But he might have guessed what she was thinking, for his next remark was curiously apposite. "I'm not sure that the obvious people are not the most fortunate," he said with a little laugh. "They know exactly what they want, which not infrequently means that what they have to do to get it is equally plain. It must necessarily save them a good many perplexities. Now, take the case of my very obvious comrade, Ingleby. Well, Ingleby wants to make a fortune placer mining, which is, from your point of view, a most reprehensible thing. Sewell laughed. That is not quite the point. Perhaps he means to do good with it, and it ought to be quite plain that Ingleby has no real sympathy with communist notions. In any case, he sets about it in the simplest fashion by working most of every day and often half the night as well. The result is that he has acquired what is apparently a competence and is more or less contented with everything. Anyone can see it in the way he looks at you lately. Grace smiled, for it was evident that there were directions in which Sewell's penetration was defective. The fortune will probably come later, she said, and then... Yes, said Sewell with a little gesture of comprehension. Since he has made his mind up, he will, I fancy, manage that too. Ingleby is that kind of person. Then if he does not do so sooner, he will naturally marry Hetty Ledger. Grace turned to him sharply, and then directed his attention to the fact that the door at the bottom of the stove admitted rather too much draft. He was a moment or two adjusting it, and when he looked up again, she was smiling indifferently. You are sure of that? She said.
Oh, I think so. Ingleby invariably does the obvious thing, and she is eminently suited to him. I'm not sure he recognizes it yet, but it will certainly become evident, and then he will save himself and everybody trouble by marrying her offhand.
Grace sat silent for almost a minute. It was perfectly clear that Sewell did not know what his comrade's aspirations were, even as Ingleby did not know how far her acquaintance with Sewell went. She was not altogether displeased that it should be so, though she felt that it would, after all, make no great change in their relations to each other had they been aware. She did not desire Sewell as a lover, though it was pleasant to feel that he valued her approbation and that she had his confidence. There are, of course, advantages in doing the obvious thing, she said with a little laugh. I suppose we are really different from Ingleby in that respect.
Sewell looked at her reflectively.
I think you are. One could almost fancy you wanted so many things that you couldn't quite decide which was the most important and give up the rest. The difficulty is that we can't very often have them all, you see. It seemed to Grace that there was some truth in this.
You, she said, speak feelingly, as though it were from sympathy.
Well, said Sewell with a curious little smile, perhaps I do. In fact, I'm not sure I'm not diagnosing my own case. A little while ago, I had a purpose and believed in it, though the belief naturally cost me a good deal.
The creation of a new utopia out of the wreck of the present social fabric?
Asked Grace, a trifle maliciously. Something of that kind, though I did not expect to do it all myself. While I was sure the thing was feasible, the fact that I was, or so I felt, taking a little share in bringing it about was sufficient for me. Now, however, I am not quite so sure on any point as I used to be, which is why I often envy Ingleby.
Grace felt a little thrill of satisfaction.
He had, of course, spoken vaguely, but she wondered how far she was responsible for the change in the opinions which he had held until a little while ago. She knew that he had borne a good deal because of them, for Ingleby had told her so. Then there may be a little good in a few of our institutions as they stand, she said. Of course, answered Sewell, who smiled again. Most of them are, however, capable of improvement. I am quite as sure of that as ever. The question is whether anybody would gain much if it were affected too rudely.
Grace was not greatly interested in the point. She preferred a more personal topic,
but she saw an opportunity for trying how far her influence went. It had been a trifle painful to find that Ingleby had not yielded to it when she had desired him to spend the winter in Vancouver and leave somebody else to hold Tomlinson's claim. Sewell was, she recognized, a cleverer man than he, and it would be consoling if he showed himself more amenable. "I think not, at least so far as anybody in the Green River country is concerned," she said. "It seems to me that its tranquility depends a good deal on you."
"On me?" Grace smiled. "Of course, you know it as well as I do. Wouldn't it be better for your friends to put up with a few little grievances rather than run the risk of bringing a worse thing upon themselves? Would we do that?"
"I think so. The major is a lenient commissioner, and the law would be too strong for you."
Sewell laughed. "That," he said, "would have to be proved, and I am not sure it is a good reason you are offering me."
Grace nodded. "No," she said, "perhaps it isn't. You rather like opposition, don't you? Still, I think one could leave it to your good sense. While I would especially like to see all quiet this winter in the Green River Valley. That, however, could, of course, scarcely be thought a reason at all."
Sewell made no disclaimer, but he looked at her with a curious intensity.
"Events," he said slowly, "may be too strong for me, and when I am sure they are right, I cannot go counter to my opinions."
"Of course," and the girl leaned forward a little nearer him, resting one hand on the arm of her chair. "That is more than I would ever ask of you. Still, perhaps you could..."
Sewell looked at her gravely and laid his hand upon the one that rested on the chair.
"I will," he said quietly, "with that one reservation, do whatever appears most likely to preserve tranquility."
Grace did not shake his grasp off, as she should have done. Indeed, a little thrill of triumph ran through her as she realized the significance of what had happened. The man who held her hand fast had borne imprisonment for his beliefs and had also braved hostile mobs, hired bravos, detachments of U.S. cavalry. And now she had made him captive with a smile. It was, from one point of view, a notable achievement, and it did not dawn on her that if regarded from another point, what she had done might wear a different aspect. Just then a book in the other room was closed with a bang, and Grace drew her hand away as Colthurst came in.
"Sorry to leave you alone so long, but we can get the chessmen out at last," he said.
Sewell set out the pieces, and Grace, who flashed a little smile at him, which implied that there was now a confidence between them, took up a book. As it happened, neither of them knew that Prospector Tomlinson was plodding down the trail that led south through the leagues of forest and snow-blocked defiles towards the settlements just then. Though the fact had its results for both of them. A half moon hung low above the white shoulder of a hill, and here and there a shaft of silvery light shone down upon the snowy trail which wound in and out through the gloom of the firs. Tomlinson was one of the simple-minded persons who content themselves with doing the obvious thing, and as it was quite plain to him that he could not stay at the bakery without probability of being discovered and getting his host into trouble, he had, in spite of Hetty's protests, persisted in setting out for the settlements, though he was still scarcely capable of the journey,
and it had been pointed out that there was a likelihood of his falling in with the police troopers. The latter fact did not, however, so far as Tomlinson could see, affect the question. The one thing that was clear to him was that he could not permit Hetty and Tom Ledger to involve themselves in difficulties. He carried 2 rolled-up blankets and a good many pounds of provisions, as well as a Marlin rifle, for it was a very long way to the settlements, and the snow was deep in the passes. He also walked slowly and with an effort, for the strength he had exhausted had scarcely come back to him yet, while the dusty snow balled beneath his worn-out boots. The bush was very still, for only a low murmur came up from the pines above the rapids, which were free of ice. The trees rose above him, solid spires of blackness, cut sharp against the white hillside beyond them, and Tomlinson was glad of their shadow, because the corporal and one of the troopers had gone down the trail that afternoon, and uncertain whether they had come back, he had no wish to meet them. It is scarcely likely that he would have done so, for he had an excellent sense of hearing, and was making very little noise. Had not a trooper stopped to do something to his newly issued winter coat, which did not fit him comfortably, he spent some little time over it, as it was necessary to take off his big mittens, and the corporal improved the occasion by sitting down on a fallen tree to light his pipe. They were both a little outside the trail and in black shadow. Tomlinson, in the meanwhile, came to an open space, some 2 or 3 score yards across. There were black firs all about it, but the snow among them seemed deeper, and as he could hear nothing but the murmur of the river, he made haste to cross it. It appeared advisable that nobody should see him. He had almost reached the gloom of the firs again, when he heard a little scraping sound, not unlike that of the rubbing of a sulfur match would make, and he stood still listening, until a faint blue radiance appeared amidst the trees. And then he moved toward the nearest undergrowth with long and almost noiseless strides. In another moment he stopped abruptly, and a man in uniform, who came out from the dark gap of the trail, also stopped and appeared to gaze at him. He carried a carbine. The men were close together, and the moon, which had just cleared the dark fir tops, shone down on both of them. The miner's face, as the policeman saw, was drawn and grim. "Tomlinson!" he gasped, and then appeared to shake his astonishment from him. "Stop, right where you are!" Tomlinson said nothing, but springing forward hurled himself into the undergrowth, which opened with a crash and then closed behind him, while the trooper, who glanced over his shoulder as if to see where the corporal was, wasted another moment. Then he too sped across the little gap in the forest, floundering through loose snow, and fell into a barberry bush which held him fast. So far, fortune had favored Tomlinson. But as he flitted through the bush, looking for a little by-trail which he knew was near, the corporal appeared suddenly from behind a tree and threw his carbine up. "Hold on," he said, "I've something to say to you." A stray gleam of moonlight that shone down just there flung a patch of brightness athwart the snow, and Tomlinson could see the white face pressed down on the carbine stock, but he did not pull up. Instead, he leapt into the shadow, and in another second there was a pale flash, and a sharp detonation rang among the trunks. Then he whipped behind a tree, and seeing 2 men close behind him now, flung up his rifle. In his country, a man who is shot usually considers himself warranted in retaliating, and Tomlinson was accustomed to the rifle. In fact, he handled it much as an English sportsman does a gun, by the balance of it, and with an instinctive sense of direction which did not necessitate the aligning of the sights. The result of this was that as the butt came home to his shoulder, the trooper dropped his carbine with a cry, and Tomlinson sprang away once more through the smoke. He might have got away altogether, but the corporal could shoot as well as he could, When a few seconds later, the fugitive felt a stinging pain in one shoulder. He staggered but recovered himself again, and running a few yards farther, dropped into a thicket and wriggled under it on his hands and knees. Then, while an unpleasant faintness crept over him, he felt for the long knife which the prospector uses for cutting up an occasional deer. It did not appear advisable to snap another cartridge into the rifle breech just then, and the knife would prove equally serviceable if his pursuers crawled into the thicket after him. Prospector Tomlinson was, like most of the men who sojourn in that wilderness, a little primitive in his notions, and the troopers had fired on him. One of them made a good deal of noise floundering through a belt of undergrowth just then, and only stopped when the corporal called to him. "Where's that blame brunch trail?" he asked. "It's right here," said the trooper. "I guess our man's lit out along it." Time was of some consequence, and the corporal did not deem it advisable to stop and consider. A man floundering through the undergrowth would, he reasoned, be heard a long way off, while a bushman could proceed with very little noise along a beaten track. Thus, as he could hear nothing, it appeared very probable that Tomlinson had taken the ladder. He and the trooper pushed on along it for a while, but there was no sign of the prospector, and they came back moodily to where they had last seen him, and proceeded to search every thicket in the vicinity. They spent at least an hour over it, but there was still no appearance of Tomlinson, and at last the corporal sat down disgustedly upon the fallen fir. "I feel most certain I plugged him once," he said. "What'd you let go your carbine for?" The trooper held the weapon up in the moonlight and glanced at the gray smear down the barrel. Then he held up his left hand, which was stained with red. "I'm not quite sure if the top of one of my fingers is on or not," he said. "Anyway, my mitten's full of blood." The corporal nodded curtly. "I guess it will grow again," he said. "Well, it seems to me nobody could do anything more tonight. We'll pick up his trail as soon as it's daylight." Then they shook the powdery snow from them and plodded on towards the outpost. Join me next time on the Sagebrush Trail for more Western Adventure in Delilah of the Snows by Harold Benlos.